You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where if making angry statements about your enemies led to diplomatic solutions, we'd be the ultimate negotiators. Well, at least I would. Do I have to hate myself now because I have something in common with Trump? And if you hate me because I have something in common with Trump, or you want to give me my condolences, give me some condolences for about that, you can do so up on iTunes, leave us a 5-star review, and tell me why I shouldn't feel bad. Alternately, if you don't think I'm as bad as Trump, support us on Patreon, patreon.com/themidside or themidside.com/patreon. I'm your host, Justin M. Wisniewski, and joining me this trip from our nation's capital, Daniel T. Richards.
Ever seen Blazing Saddles, Justin?
A long, long time ago.
There's a scene with Madeline Kahn where she sings a song that goes basically, "I'm so tired." That's the song. That's how I feel right now. I could pass out at any moment. I might, in the middle of this episode, while reading the news, just fall asleep.
Could happen. Now, is this because of the steel tariffs? Is this because of the Trump-Korea negotiations?
Because, or
is this
because you've been working forever? Of economic illiteracy. It's made me literally tired. Yes. No. I worked all weekend. Long hours. One of our bigger conferences of the year was this weekend, and it was in D.C., and it was exhausting. So I'm going to try not to be low-energy Daniel this episode. Please clap. And I think getting my energy up by mentioning the tariffs was a good rhetorical move on your point, because Jesus H. Christos, the guy pushes through tax cuts, says it's good for the economy, and then wants tariffs, which are terrible for the economy. Basic economics, terrible. And it leads me to believe that he is an idiot. Nothing he's done so far has dissuaded me from the idea that he's just stupid. So
I think he's just shooting wildly.
I'm going to put that in the stupid bucket. Like, if you made me like bozos, like, I'm going to put it in that first. Yeah, he's just an idiot bucket. It's an easy toss.
Was that a Bozo the Clown reference?
Yes, it was. Thank you.
That's how you know you're tired.
Oy vey. Are you tired?
But I need you to wake up, because James is not here this week.
Oh.
Because, and I want to ask you about this, because you are an owner of a young dog as well, right? Xerxes is a young dog. Now, I think Xerxes is not as big as Daphne is. But
correct.
The reason James is missing this week, this episode, is because his young dog ate a very large bone.
Yes.
How does that happen? Like, if I were a dog owner and I were to give my dog a bone, knick-knack, paddywhack, give my dog a bone, I would then watch the dog to make sure the dog did not swallow the bone.
Likely, what happened, and we'll have to wait for James's report next week, is that the dog got the bone out of the garbage or stole it off a table. And contrary to popular belief, you should probably not give your dog bones at all, which is why I suspect James didn't actually give the dog a bone. You should not give your dogs bones, because they can fragment, and it's a bad, bad thing. You give them these artificial bones that dissolve in their mouth and only make them want more. So, probably
see,
an accident.
I thought that there were just lots of bones being given all around, and that's how the dog ended up swallowing a bone.
Mm.
No, there was just so much distraction.
Too much bone giving at James's residence, is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Good theory. We'll see next week what James has to say about the bone giving. But yeah, you don't want to give dogs bones, typically. There are exceptions to that. And Xerxes is also a wild chewer, and he will eat anything. Our dog likes Indian food, Justin.
Well, you named the thing Xerxes. What the fuck did you think was going to happen?
I've owned many dogs in my lifetime. All of them have hated spicy food. This dog will eat literally anything. So we have to keep tables clear. We have to keep the garbage out all the time, constantly. Because he is a monster. A monster!
Wait, so having a dog makes you do your chores?
It makes us do them more judiciously than we would. We would take the garbage out, let's say, every other day instead of twice a day. Etc.
Well, that sounds like a good reason everyone should be mandated to have a dog. But when you're talking about dogs and you're talking about bones, it sounds like you're telling me that an inclusion rider for a dog should not include giving that dog a bone, right? Mm-hmm.
Correct.
But what is an inclusion rider? I don't know. Well, I do know because I read the story. But we're going to have you tell everyone else what it is as you read the story in the news with Daniel T. Richards.
It really is that bad. These aren't harmless criminals. This isn't just a fad.
Inclusion riders. Are they a libertarian solution to workplace inequality or PC run amok? Reason Blog asks. Nick Gillespie writes.
You know what the answer is, right?
FDB.
That's right.
Say it.
Franklin Delano bullshit.
That's right. False dichotomy, bro. But here, let's get into the story a little bit. So what the heck are we talking about? At the Oscars, Best Actress winner Frances McDormand mentioned inclusion riders in an acceptance speech that foregrounded issues of gender equity in Hollywood. After asking all the women in the audience who had been nominated for an award to stand up, McDormand concluded, quote, "Look around, ladies and gentlemen, because we all have stories to tell and projects we need financed. Don't talk to us about it at the parties tonight. Invite us into your office in a couple days, or you can come to ours, whatever suits you best, and we'll tell you all about them. I have two words to leave with you tonight, ladies and gentlemen. Inclusion rider." So what the heck is an inclusion rider? Comedian, is she funny? Whitney Cummings explains that an inclusion rider is something actors put into their contracts to ensure gender and racial equality in hiring on movie sets. We should support it for a billion reasons, she argues. But if you can't find a reason to, here's one. It'll make movies better. Furthermore, an inclusion rider typically sets diversity benchmarks, such as 50% female, 40% underrepresented ethnic groups, 20% with disabilities, 5% with LGBT. Those numbers don't add up to 100. It would also require that there be a good faith effort to ensure representation in key areas behind the camera. Failure to meet the terms of the rider would lead to a fee or a penalty for the studio or the distributor that doesn't meet the contract terms. So, Justin, my question for you is, does an inclusion rider sound like a old-timey social justice cause?
Yeah, this sounds like an episode of Black Mirror that is yet to happen, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I completely blanked because what was the joke I made in the thread about the shootout?
Shootout at the LGBT corral. That's
that was you.
I made.
Yeah.
Yes, because to me, Inclusion Rider is a social justice cause with his trusty horse Triggered.
That's it. That's good. That was the one you made. That's brilliant. That's pretty good.
Thank you. I'm going to Photoshop that. Put that out there on the internet. What is this a good thing? Should more people include these inclusion riders, Justin? What is this going to lead to?
More people should include these because they will not get hired, which will open the market for people like me. So yes, by all means, put these ridiculous demands in your contracts. I mean, look, here's the thing about all of this. Yes, it's libertarian. It's a free country. If you want to include anything in your contract, go ahead. If you want to have an inclusion rider, and we've seen this all the time with rock stars and comedians and stuff, right? That says you only want the green M&Ms backstage. That's fine. Like I heard, and I don't think it was an inclusion rider, but I heard from someone who worked with Kiefer Sutherland on the show Touch that he always needed a Coke. Like it would just be someone's job to get Kiefer Sutherland a Coke, which that doesn't seem like a very terribly complicated one. Just like have the craft services people have enough Cokes on hand for Kiefer Sutherland, like problem solved. So something like that is minor. Like I get that. But if that's the kind of irrational stuff you want to put in, fine. You have every right to. You negotiate your contract. You should never be able to have the law say you can't put certain things in your contract, obviously beyond like slavery and things like that, that are just anti-human rights, right? I want to put in that caveat. I'm not an idiot.
To go that far with your caveat. I think we all got that. Justin is anti-slavery. Everyone write
that
down.
I don't know. Nowadays, like, I don't want to, like, in 10 years, like, this podcast comes up and be like, oh, you can negotiate anything. So you're pro-slavery? Yes, that's my point. I'm pro-slavery. Yes, you got me. I'm pro- See,
drop.
Even just that quote I just said
Get
right there.
That drop. Yeah.
Yep. That drop, I just fucked myself for life. So yeah, you can negotiate what you want in your contract. It's a free country, right? It's a free world. You should be able to negotiate what you want. But what is the philosophical foundation of what you are negotiating? If you're negotiating solely based upon the fact of the gender and the race and the religion, even the philosophy of the people who are working on set with you, like if you were an objectivist making a movie, like say when Zack Snyder makes The Fountainhead, he's like, I have to have 30% objectivists working on this set. No, you want to have the best people working on your set, regardless of race, gender, creed, height, whatever the fuck, weight, I don't care. All of those things, sexuality, none of that matters. You just want the best people. So sure, go ahead, have these inclusion writers. But Whitney Cummings saying, and by the way, Whitney Cummings has the like perfect last name for her. You asked if she's funny. She's not funny, but she's just one of these comedians that's like, hey, look, I'm a woman who loves to talk about this fact that I have lots of sex and it's raunchy. Therefore, I'm funny. So her last name is perfect for her bit. But if she wants to sit there and talk about how this is better and it will make better movies, what is her standard of better? There's this mythical idea out there that if you have a diversity of voices, that necessarily they have better and different things to say. As if somehow what you have to say is linked to any of these things I just named. And that's the ridiculous part about this. That's what the Midside is about, right? We're not just talking about, at least for me, it's not just about what government should or shouldn't do. I'm very much pro-small government. Very pro-small government. Very small government. But then there's also, just because you can do something doesn't mean you should do something. And I also think it's important to talk about when we're free and we have the choice to make these, you know, these free choices, when we have the freedom to make these choices, what are the consequences of them? And this is a perfect example. You are free to say whatever you want in your contract, to have whatever criteria deals you want in there. But like if Rob Gronkowski was like, I need to be thrown to by a black quarterback 35% of the time. Like how wouldn't that hurt the quality of play on the field? Because you're not looking for the best quarterback, you'd be subbing in Kaepernick for Tom Brady 35% of the time.
But at least it would be more diverse. It's, I mean, when you say it that way, it just it's so blatantly idiotic. Plus, you've covered all the moral points, so I'll go into a different area here, which is, yes, you should be free to have whatever contract you want. Justin, I totally agree with you, but in fact, I think this actually might be illegal. To point out maybe what's not so obvious. So, for instance, discrimination based on race, like if you hired an unqualified white person over a qualified black person, that would be discrimination based on race. That is illegal in the United States. Whether or not it should be is an interesting question, especially when you reverse it. So like these gun stores, for instance, we've been talking about this a little bit in the Welcome to the Midside thread, who are no longer going to sell guns to 18-year-olds. Turns out you can't discriminate based on age. These are laws the left hails all the time. And now when they're trying to use them for their own advantage, they're like, oh yeah, these laws suck. It's like, oh, okay, interesting. People should be free to do what they want. Interesting. So this may actually be illegal. And additionally, where does this end in terms of quotas? Do you need... Like, if you're making a movie about a nunnery, for instance, do you need 50% of the actors to be male? Do you need 50% of them to be black? Do you need 50% to be gay? Like, when can we just make movies? Make the movies we want to make. And if you want to make a movie with an all-black cast, an all-gay cast, an all-trans cast, a half-trans cast, any mixture of these things, why don't you just do that? Why don't you just focus on what you want to do? Why don't you just focus on working projects that you want to create and stop worrying about telling other people what they should be doing with their lives and their projects. And
their argument is that they can't get the funding for these projects otherwise. That's their argument.
How much money does Frances McDormand have? Why doesn't she fund a movie like that? Plus, with the whole distribution thing, like, you need less and less money now that the internet has opened up things. Why not take a stand against Hollywood right here, Frances McDormand? Don't go to these big production companies anymore. Make your own movies that follow your own standards of values and judgments and whatever, and let's see what it does in the marketplace of ideas. Let's see. Maybe you're right. Maybe Whitney Cummings is right. Maybe movies that have perfect ratios of inclusivity, whatever that means, will be better movies, and if you are, you shouldn't be afraid to go out and make them without having to force other people into your views. I'm not saying that they're forcing via government, but this whole inclusion rider nonsense. Go do it. See what happens. I don't know what'll happen, especially in this terrible culture in which we live, where we value things like diversity and inclusion over things like, I don't know, aesthetics, story, plot, character development, etc. Maybe she's right. Maybe they will be quote-unquote better in the context of the crap society in which we live.
Well, isn't it interesting what you just pointed out? Isn't it interesting psychologically that these people won't take that risk with the amount of money they have? Take, for example, a Robert Downey Jr. Mm-hmm. Right now, I do think he optioned a Black Mirror episode that he's trying to turn into a feature film. I don't know the details, but I read that somewhere. But someone like that is an extreme example. But even someone like that, that let's say makes $5 million on a movie, right? Even if the government takes $2.5 million from that, right? Let's be generous to the government. Say they take half of what you make. So you have $2.5 million. Isn't that enough money with the technology that's out there nowadays to make a movie that could potentially be big? I mean, look at someone like James Wan. Do you know how James Wan, the director of Aquaman, got his start?
No, I do not.
He made the movie Saw. The movie Saw is known for spawning a franchise that is low-budget horror and then makes hundreds of millions of dollars when they release it, so the profit margin is huge. So then he got noticed because he was able to do that. He's made other horror movies with the same sort of budget/profit margin, and now he's directing Aquaman, a major blockbuster. This is an Asian director, right? James Wan. He did it with that kind of money. Now, I don't know how he got the first one financed. I'm not saying he's self-financing, but I'm saying any of these actors who have that kind of money should be able to self-finance or finance one of these pictures. Even if they don't do it themselves, they can go out and find a James Wan and finance them. But psychologically, they don't feel like they can, which is sort of mixed in with this whole, we need to have it in here that we need inclusion risers so we're going to be represented. We can't just be represented based on merit. It's this whole sort of external locus of control they have where they don't think they can do these things. They need somebody else to do them for them. It's interesting.
Yeah. I think Kevin Sorbo will have an inclusion rider in his future things that say they have to have 50% conservative cast members.
I mean, is he even allowed to make movies anymore? Remember when Kevin Sorbo was like the biggest thing in the 90s and now like everyone just makes fun of him for being conservative?
Yeah. I'm just curious where this ends. I mean, right now the biggest lack of diversity in Hollywood is in ideas and thinking. So, I don't know. Just curious. Conservatives do that.
Again, we talk about how I saw this at my school before anything else. We talked about that at our school. Everyone was complaining at Ithaca when I was in school from 01 to 05 about how there was no diversity on campus. And we pushed back. I was in the Republican group at that point. And we pushed back and we said, shouldn't there be an intellectual diversity issue? It's all the same ideas here. There's no libertarian ideas on this campus. There's no small government ideas. I mean, even I'm sitting there in the Republican meetings, and this is one of my first things that was like, fuck, I don't like the Republicans. They were all arguing for government as solutions too. So even back then I was saying intellectual diversity, and now that's the major issue that needs to be trumpeted. It's crazy.
We'll get to that in Trailer Takedown. It's going to be a good time. But before we get there, let's talk about Geek Squad. Geek Squad, everyone's favorite computer repair service from Best Buy. Well, it turns out the new documents reveal that FBI paid Geek Squad to act as informants. Indeed. The relationship between the FBI and employees of Best Buy's computer and repair Unit Geek Squad is more complex than first thought, according to newly released documents. This is from ZDNet. Records posted Tuesday by the Electronic Frontier Foundation, EFF, following a Freedom of Information lawsuit filed last year, revealed that federal agents would pay Geek Squad managers who pass on information about illegal materials on devices sent in for customer repairs. The relationship goes back at least 10 years, according to documents released. The aim of the FBI's Louisville division was to maintain a, quote, close liaison with Geek Squad management to, quote, glean case initiations and to support the division's computer intrusion and cybercrime programs. Of course, the problem with this is that it's likely a Fourth Amendment violation, because this would be essentially obtaining information without a warrant. Justin, what illegal information has the FBI gleaned from your computers via Geek Squad?
I mean, I probably shouldn't say this. First of all, I don't think I've ever been to Geek Squad, maybe like back in the day when I worked at Best Buy for like 6 months. But I mean, I've downloaded TV shows. I mean, rather than, I never had a DVR. So rather than, you know, DVR something the night it came out, I would just torrent it. So I'm sure if they were at the Geek Squad, they would have gotten that information from me, like when I was in college and back in the day. So, I mean, here's the thing. If you bring your computer to somewhere like the Geek Squad, assume that all of your child pornography will be found and reported.
Yeah.
Like, isn't this
child
obvious?
Child porn viewers who listen to this podcast.
Also, if you're a child porn listener, if you are a child porn viewer and you are listening to the show, please identify yourself. We want to help you. I just want to know your name.
I mostly want to give you over to the FBI, but yeah, go ahead.
Well, that was what I, that was why I said help you in that way, to insinuate that. Thank you for explaining my joke, douchebag. Mm-hmm. But look, am I the only one who was not surprised by this story? It was like, oh, the FBI has been using the Geek Squad. No shit, Sherlock. Like, wouldn't that be the first thing? It's like, hey, these people get unfettered access to people's computers. Like, as I said, anytime you bring anything in there, assume they're looking at it. I mean, it's the same thing like back in the day, before iPhones and everything and digital cameras were so prevalent in digital pictures. When you took your pictures to get developed at like Walmart or CVS, if you had nude pictures in there, you know the people made copies of them, right? And kept them?
I assume.
Yeah, like, you have to know your stuff is being looked at. I bet you they even copied, if you had nude pictures on your computer, the Geek Squad members might have copied them. So it's not a surprise the FBI would do this. Here's my question for you, though, legally, Daniel. Is there a difference between the FBI saying, hey, give us this stuff, and if, in the child porn example, a Geek Squad member found child porn on it and then reported it to the FBI? What is the difference there legally?
So the question is, essentially, did the FBI pay people to actively look for things which would violate the terms of service between the user and Best Buy? Or did the FBI simply pay people for doing what you suggested, which is when they accidentally found things, turn it over? Part of the complicating factor here is that the FBI is under no obligation to pay people for turning things over like that, because it says right in the contract with Best Buy, if we find illegal stuff, specifically child porn, we are going to turn it over, but we are not going to look for it. That is, if we're, you know, saving files and one pops up, then we're going to turn it over, but we're not going to be, you know, control effing. That sounds horrible. We're not going to be searching your computer for, you know, kiddie porn .jpg or whatever it is. So the question is, were these people now actively looking for illegal activity that they were turning over to the FBI? There's an additional question of whether or not the FBI needed a search warrant anyway to get this information. But there's this thing in the United States courts called third-party doctrine. We may have talked about this a little bit. Basically, the idea is, if you turn over information to a third party, courts believe that you have no reasonable expectation of privacy in that information. So even like the fact that you use Gmail and your Gmails are saved on a Google server, the FBI wouldn't necessarily need a warrant to get that information. Google could hand that over voluntarily because you have no reasonable expectation of privacy because it's Google server, not yours. Which is why Hillary Clinton was using her own email server.
Wow, you went there, huh?
That's literally why.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it is because she knows the law. And it's not even just the law, it's the logic. It's what I was just saying. If you give something to someone else, don't expect that it's private anymore. You know, it's the whole idea that if you have a secret and you tell somebody else, assume that more people are going to know.
Yeah.
That's the thing. Once I tell somebody else something that was in my head and only in my head, I assume that it's going to go elsewhere.
But the question
is, it's just not private anymore. That's not the way the world works.
The question of the modern era for me is, do you have an expectation of privacy when you turn over things to a third party? Do I expect that Best Buy is going to keep my file information to themselves? Obviously, if it's not a crime, but whatever it is, do I expect they'll keep it to themselves? Do I expect my bank to keep my records to themselves? Do I expect Gmail to keep my emails to themselves and to me? Isn't this a new era where we have electronic information everywhere that we don't see the bank or Gmail or even Best Buy as a quote third party with that information? It's not the same as actively telling a friend a secret, or is it?
Well, I think there's a difference between banking and Gmail. I mean, the service of the bank is to keep your money safe, right?
Yeah. But there's
information. So can they be keeping your money safe if they're going around telling people how much money you have?
There's a whole bunch of information, transaction information, things that you buy, like the names of or places that you buy from. You know, I'm short and have a small penis.com would come up in your bank statement, for instance. But so do you expect the bank to keep that private? Or is that like telling a friend that you visit sites that have to do with your height and junk?
Well, I don't know why they would be lying about me. I mean, that seems a little malevolent to lie out of nowhere about me.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I'm saying is, I think the question is, and again, I'm not a legal scholar and this isn't a legal podcast, but the question for me is, where is the line between doing your job and information that isn't necessary to doing your job? All the stuff you just described to me is, as a bank, I would think that would be important to keeping your customers' finances safe, which is what your job is as a bank, to keep their money safe.
Well, why doesn't that work for Gmail? Isn't Gmail's job to keep your emails safe?
Oh, I agree. So I'm asking where the line is.
I think the line is way further back. I think the line is that there should be no third-party doctrine. I think that the government should be malevolent unless proven otherwise. Assumed malevolent unless proven otherwise, which means the government should have to get a warrant if they want the information from the bank, from Gmail, from Best Buy, whatever. And this isn't to say, obviously, that I'm in favor of criminals. I don't want people downloading child porn. I want them put in jail. They're horrible human beings. But the point is that when the government doesn't have to go through these hoops, when there's an assumed benevolence on the part of the government, and they don't have to follow the procedures, that's when all of law and order breaks down. We need more.
Okay, I agree with you.
Malevolence,
100%.
Yeah,
I agree with you 100%. Everything you just said, but again, there is what should be and what is realistic. Even if the third party doctrine was not on the books, I would not assume any information I have out there is safe.
Agreed, and that's the difference between what we want legally and what you should do, just as a matter of being alive in the world.
Yes.
So, speaking of being alive but not in the world, one girl's quest for Instagram stardom left her in financial ruin. Lisette Calvero moved to New York from Miami in 2013 for an internship. She felt like she was living in a Sex and the City dream. This is from a New York Post article, by the way. The now 26-year-old was having brunch with friends and buying new outfits online and documenting it all on her Instagram account. Quote, I wanted to tell my story about this young millennial living in New York. I was shopping for clothes to take the perfect gram. And although her social media life looked glamorous, she was struggling financially, given that her internship only paid a transportation stipend. Lee. Living off her savings, she also got a part-time retail job, even after she moved back to Miami in fall of 2013, that was a short internship, and landed a full-time publicist gig. Calvero sank $10,000 into debt trying to live, and this is my favorite line, an Instagram-worthy life. So is this a cautionary tale, Justin, of the unreality of social media, or is this a redemption story? Because, spoiler alert, she does turn her life around by the end of this article. What say you?
I mean, I think you just walked into another false dichotomy, bro, didn't you?
I try to set up false dichotomies so that you can tear them down. It's really cool.
Oh, okay, I see how that works. I have a question for you, though. Mm. Did you just, instead of saying glamorous, try to say grammarous?
I tried, life? And then I like sort of stumbled over it because my brain didn't want me to say it.
Yeah. So is that, is that like being glamorous for Instagram?
Yeah.
Or is that just if you're glamorous in Asia?
You might have to ask your girlfriend.
Right, and does that explain why Instagram is so popular in Asia and why my girlfriend won't get off Instagram?
Because everyone lives a glamorous life.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Or is that you're just really good at grammar?
It could be all of those things. It could be that you're a fabulous grandma.
I think there's causality backwards in the story. And this is something that I want to ask you about because, like, you're a social media guy and I'm a social media guy professionally. So there's an interesting discussion here. It seems like there's causality backwards here, mm-hmm. where they're trying to become Instagram famous and Instagram influencers. So they're trying to live an Instagram worthy life. Shouldn't it be you have a good life and then you Instagram it? The idea of designing your life for Instagram seems really backwards and fake. And that's something I don't understand about all of these things. And this is where the discussion I want to have with you is. It seems to me nowadays people are obsessed with just putting their day-to-day common life on Instagram.
Nowadays.
Oh, well, I just went to the gym. Oh, I just had a blueberry pie. Oh, I just tried to talk to this guy and it failed. Like, I don't understand what people are doing on Instagram. And then these people become influencers. And that's my question is, how effective is this influencer culture as marketing? Because when you think of like a lot of like email opening, right? Only like a 1% open rate for an email you send out. Think of everybody out there, all the midsiders out there. When you get a newsletter from a company or like, you know, I get Hot Topic, like, oh, look at these new Funko Pops. If they get a 1% open rate, that's considered good when they send that out. And then you figure the click-through rate where someone clicks on a link and buys something is even smaller. So when you have these small accounts, even if you have 1 million followers on Instagram, let's be generous, you have 1 million followers on Instagram, how many people are you actually reaching when you find someone with 1 million followers, you say, hey, pimp our sunglasses, and say, hey, I got these, use this 10% off code. Is that even really effective, or have we convinced ourselves it's effective because we have this backwards causality?
Yeah, there's a lot going on here. I think this girl had 13,000 followers, by the way, so just shy of 1 million.
Yeah.
If you're rounding in the wrong direction. But
yeah,
there's a couple things going on here. One is that social media has become reality social media, much like reality TV, it might have started as, like, we want to document what's going on in real life, and that's interesting to some degree, but now it's totally contrived for the sake of the medium. That's a lot of what's going on in social media. And I think there are a couple reasons for this. And one is, I'm not going to go so far as to say it's a basic human thing, but it's certainly a basic millennial thing now. And that might have to do with a certain psychology. I'll let you weigh in. And that is the question that is on millennials' minds all the time is this normal? Am I living life like everyone else is living life? It's sort of a social proof kind of thing. Oh, this is what other people are doing, so I'm not so weird and bad and horrible. Like, I'm just normal because I can look at these other people who are normal and they're doing this thing. So that's a lot of what's driving this and why people putting their everyday life online is appealing, because it's proof. It's proof that I am not terrible for doing these things as well. I also eat blueberries for breakfast and go to the gym and only lift the weight once. I'm like everyone else. I want to fit in. And then the other element of it that you were talking about is effective marketing. It's sort of a catch-22 in a certain sense, which is that I don't think it is particularly effective marketing in most cases, because the thing that drives sales, so not just this looky-loo culture, but the things that drive sales is authenticity. And I think we're really, really missing out on a culture of authenticity now in social media. It's become all contrived normcore nonsense. So that's my dissertation on the state of social media. Thank you.
Normcore, huh? I like that. I like that. I mean, the thing that's interesting about what you said is the second-handedness of am I normal, right? I think normal became a second-handed word. And it became second-handed, and it wasn't normal as in healthy. To me, normal means healthy. Whenever I was young and I was like, this doesn't feel right, I don't feel normal, I meant that I wasn't living a healthy human life. But now normal, as you've just said, where it's what is everyone else doing? Oh, I'm doing what everyone else does, so I'm normal, so I'm okay. Normal has become second-handed, as in what is the mean or what is the average person doing? If the most people are doing this, that is normal, therefore it is healthy. That is socially based. It's not reality based. Now, yeah, and when I say reality, I don't mean this as Daniel called it nonfiction television or nonfiction social media, to quote Mark Burnett. He called it nonfiction television, not reality television, for something like Survivor or The Apprentice. So as Daniel's referring to that nonfiction social media, I'm not talking about the second-handedness of that. There's an interesting thing here. Psychologically, what Daniel's asking about is there's two things. There's the narcissism we always talk about. Narcissism, believe it or not, is ultimately second-handed. It's the idea that not only do I have to seem, and not only do I seem to have this elevated sense of importance, but it's that I need other people to think that I am important. And that ultimately comes from a lack of self-esteem. And I think that's really where this is all coming from. Ultimately, we've been told the individual doesn't matter, the collective matters. And when that happens, you feel like your individual life doesn't matter, aka a lack of self-esteem, and all you want to do is fit into the group. And I think that's what we're seeing on social media. I mean, one of the things that bugs me is these Patriots fan meme accounts, where you're watching a game, and as the game is happening, they're posting about the game. And we talked about this on Belichick Your Premises. And Daniel, as you said, they're not really fans. They're pretending to be fans. Because you can't be watching the game and paying attention to it and understanding it and making memes at the same time. The human brain just doesn't work that way. You just don't have that much energy and you don't have that much multitasking ability. It's not possible.
Or if you do, Jesus, work for Facebook or Apple or NASA or something. Don't be making memes on the internet.
Right. So what you're more concerned about is fitting into a group and what's the group you belong to, because you have a lack of self-esteem for yourself. And that's what is going on with social media right now. When you look at this, look at how it manifested. This is why this is a cautionary tale and a redemption tale, because she saw that ultimately this behavior is self-destructive because of the lack of self-esteem. The way it's self-destructive is she wasn't taking care of herself financially. And ultimately, it led to her having to take care of herself financially. She had to make a decision. Ultimately, it led to live or die. Make your choice. It was a weird, social media became a weird jigsaw trap for her.
Yeah. One little nuance that I want to hammer home is that the norm core, the is this normal question, almost always has nothing to do with what is actually normal and has to do, I think, mostly with can I rationalize the bad behavior by saying that this is what a lot of other people are doing, like eating blueberries for dinner every night, for instance. If I can find my blueberry eating community, it just becomes a rationalization for normality. Like, this is normal, so I can do it.
Oh, that's 100% what it is. Nobody wants to, when they ask or they say, like, this is what is going on, is everyone else seeing this? Nobody wants to be told, no, get help, fix yourself. They want to be told, oh, yes, I'm suffering in that way as well. This is the, if you've read my Back in the Day, Real or Ideal, you know, the Man of Steel piece, right? The Choice of Steel, that's what it was. Real or Ideal, The Choice of Steel, whether you wanted to be a romantic Superman or a naturalistic Superman, it's what I call the human helplessness pact. Everyone just wants together with the idea of we can't do anything to help ourselves, and we just want to tell each other it's okay. We just want to know it's okay that we can't help each other. That's what the Oscars are all about with the virtue signaling. That's what the inclusion writers are all about. It's all, we can't help ourselves. We're just in this together to get through this suffering together. And think about how dark of a view of life that is.
Pretty dark. Pretty dark. Giddy up, Triggered. Let's move on to the next story, which is also pretty dark, when smug liberals met conservative trolls. It's a New York Times opinion piece by one Catherine Mangu Ward, who's the editor-in-chief of Reason magazine. So it's a Reason bookmarked episode this week. Don't tell James. Okay. And I don't mean that he doesn't like Reason. I mean, he doesn't like libertarians. But okay, it's fine. Okay, here we go. It's hard to tell who started it. This is the article now. Was it the populist right, reared in the meme swamps of Reddit and 4chan, who emerged blinking into the daylight of politics and set upon baiting anyone who disagreed with their chosen Republican king? Or was it liberals, cozy in their elite enclaves on the coasts, who burrowed down into self-righteousness, lecturing working-class Republicans about how they misunderstand their own interests? Modern American political discourse can seem disjointed to the point of absurdism, but the problem isn't just filter bubbles, echo chambers, or alternative facts. It's tone. When the loudest voices on the left talk about people on the right as either beyond the pale or dupes of their own betters, it is with an air of barely concealed smugness. Right-wingers, for their part, increasingly respond with a curlish, "Oh yeah, hold my beer," and then double down on what politically incorrect sentiment brought on the disdain in the first place. These two terrible tendencies now feed off each other, growing stronger every day. The more smugness, the more satisfying it is to poke holes in it, the more toxic the trolling, the greater the sense of moral superiority. The result, an odoriferous stew of political rhetoric that is nearly irresistible to those on the inside and confusingly abhorrent to those on the outside. Woo! What a start there. Justin, pick a side. Troll or elite?
Are you propping up another false dichotomy for me to break down?
Am I not in every single transition?
But here's the problem I have with this story is psychologically, I sympathize with the trolls. And what I mean by this is, since I've been growing up, and I even saw this like on the soccer field, since the time I've been a child and was growing up, it was always the person who retaliated got in trouble. That's what I was always told. And I never understood that concept, because if you get punched in the face and then you punch someone back, you get in trouble when they punch you in the face first. Isn't the entire point of the justice system to punish the person who's initiating force when they're not supposed to? That's supposed to be the point of the justice system, right? But so it got to the point that we had a whole group of people in this country being dicks and nobody was stopping them. Right? No, wait, no, hold on. I need to rewind. I have to go with the Team America World Police metaphor, okay? This is the answer to this story is Team America World Police. So let me rewind. It got to the point that we had a whole bunch of people in this country being assholes. And no one was stopping them. And as they say, this is basically me paraphrasing Team America. And what happens when you let assholes go unrefined? Well, everything gets all shitty, because they shit all over everything. That's what was going on. So then we have people who became dicks. These are the trolls. And you know what? Dicks suck because sometimes they fuck pussies. And pussies, you know, don't always deserve it because they're just minding their own business. But the assholes need to get fucked sometimes so they stop shitting on everything. And that is why I have sympathy for the trolls in this story. Because if the referee's going to let me keep getting punched in the face, well, I'll take the red card, and I never did this, but in my current psychology, I would. I'll take the red card to punch that guy in the face to let him know he can't punch me in the face. Because if the law is not going to protect me, then I have to protect myself. I mean, this is what we saw with Death Wish last episode. That's the entire point of Death Wish. The cops could not protect the character's family and could not protect people anymore, so Bruce Willis's character took it into his own hands. That's the question you have to ask. Okay. And that's what's going on ideologically, intellectually. You have the elites sitting here telling everyone else how terrible they are when they have a relativistic, non-reality-based perspective. That is, they're manipulating and playing games in order to get power. And the other side is saying, well, if you're going to say I'm bad, I'm not even going to grant you that premise. And fine, I'm bad. Fuck you. And now we have a divide.
But I think the point she's trying to make, even though I actually shockingly mostly agree with your analysis as far as I understand which vulgarity refers to which group here, insofar as that it was the left that initially started this, and it depends on when you, how far you want to go back. Like, do we want to go back to, like, friggin' Woodrow Wilson and whatnot, and how the left perpetuated this fraud against America because they knew better than the rest of the country? But I think the ultimate point here is that the right, at least the point I take from this, is that the right turned to trolling because they really didn't have anything else to do. And I think that's the sad part for me, which is that the right should have had a better intellectual response to the left, but they just didn't. Instead, they found a void, and in that void, they found the F word, and it was good. And there was much
rejoicing. Right, I agree. And I want to break this free. I want to give that better intellectual foundation by breaking this free of the right from the left.
Yes, okay? Please do.
Right now, it's on the left. And right now, it's social justice left. It's not everyone on the left, and it's not everyone on the right. I'm using assholes to refer to the social justice people. Now, who the social justice people are people like, and if you followed this podcast, you know who I mean, Devin Farsi. Devin Farsi was the blogger who hated Zack Snyder. He hated Zack Snyder for his portrayal of a selfish Superman, of a Superman who wanted to fight for his own values and fight for what he saw as good in the world. And he hated that because ultimately, Devin Farsi hates himself. He hates himself and he knows that he cannot be productive in reality as is. So he has to use words and use intellectual manipulation to get power and to get ahead. That goes directly against someone like Zack Snyder. So if we have our Farsi-Snyder dichotomy here, and both of the, I'm pretty sure Zack Snyder's a leftist too, so both of these people are leftists. What I'm talking about is throughout the history of humanity, there has always been a group of people who could not get ahead by living in line with reality and being strong, moral, and people with integrity. They could not get ahead. And it used to be humanity had systems of power, such as monarchy, that allowed those people to stay in power in spite of not being the most able and the most moral people. Now, America was supposed to be the first time that it was you would get ahead based upon your morality, because we based it on individualism, not keeping power. But these people have figured out a way to weasel into the system and try and make it so ability doesn't matter, because their only way of surviving is by making ability not matter. Now, unfortunately, we've couched it in this bullshit rhetoric of the right versus the left as if the right is on the side of ability. Yeah, Donald Trump's on the side of ability. Okay, if you want to say that. And then we have the people on the left saying they're on the side of non-ability. And then we have this battle we have, and we couch it in what this reason writer is saying. That's what I'm saying. It has nothing to do with right and left, really. It has to do with people of non-ability trying to fight against people of ability. But the problem is people of ability just want to go about their business, really.
And I think ability can mean couple different things, or something, a couple different things can stand in for it. The left would say it's privilege, or they would say it's genes, or it's luck, or it's whatever. It's basically anything other than the choices you make as a human being. Because I also don't want to put it solely on ability, which can sometimes be an inherited, innate thing that you really didn't have any choice in. And that it could be part of it, certainly, but choice is, I think, the ultimate point for me that I want to make.
Oh yeah, I wasn't using ability as in, you know, your naturally, you know, God-given or genetically given gifts, however you want to define it. I was using it as what you earned, as in, as Tom Brady says, earn it every day. That's why I was using the sports example to start with. There are two types of players in this metaphor. There's the player who goes out and works his hardest to be as good as he possibly can and just tries to win within the rules of the game on the field. And then there's the player who can't stop that player who's worked to earn that ability. And, you know, as you just said, the ability is the choices they've made to get to that point, right? at the amount that Tom Brady has colloquially sacrificed to get as good as he is, that is a choice he made. So you have the players who get that ability, and then you have the players who just want to hurt that player. You know, in the NFL, it's Ndamukong Suh, right? The number of players he's hurt, or Terrell Suggs, these type of players. And I was saying, as a kid, I saw that where they didn't. It didn't matter how good you were, somebody would just knock you over. And then if you fought back, you would get in trouble. And that's the problem. That's what the justice system is supposed to combat against. And justice has so failed in this country that the player who goes around punching people who have made the choice to be good now wins over that. So the person who made the choice says, well, I'll just punch you back then. Because justice isn't going to punish you. I don't give a shit if they punish me. You need to be punished. Do you get my point?
Yeah, I get it. I also don't see it purely as, and you don't either, I'm just pointing this out, purely as a Tom Brady v. Ndamukong Suh type of thing, but it might be, to extend the metaphor a tiny bit, a Tom Brady versus a Roger Goodell kind of thing, where you have people who are not even comparatively on literally the same field who are trying to oppress other people for any number of reasons.
There's such complexity to this, but yes. Right? So you get in charge of... Roger Goodell gets in charge of the league because he could never play like the players on the league. And it's a spectrum, right? I create an easy dichotomy, but people are mixed. So Ndamukong Suh had to do some amount of effort and make some good choices at the NFL. Right. He just has that mix. Roger Goodell is just one extreme.
Right. Indeed. So I like you, reject the troll elite dichotomy and say that both sides here are in the wrong. And I think she's trying to say that as well. I just don't think she's as articulate. So, although I like her a lot, by the way. She's great.
She's not as articulate as we are, you're saying?
Maybe. I don't think she thinks about this in the same way. She's obviously an articulate writer. I don't want to crap on Catherine Mangu Ward. She's super talented and a great person. I'm saying that she's still falling into the trap of, maybe it's just the language trap or the ideological trap. And I think we need to see outside of that.
Well, the trap is that it's the collectivist trap, and we're going to get into this,
sure.
But it's the collectivist trap. It's that you have to pick a side. The only side you have to pick in life is your own side, and that's what she's missing. All right, then. So when we're talking about collectivist traps and we're talking about one of the ways they teach it to us, it's an art. So let's go into that in The Hopeful Romantic with JML. So, Daniel, I finally did it.
You finally, I'm too tired to think of something to put you down. You finally did negative thing against yourself. There you go.
I thought you were going to make a sex joke, and I was going to say, well, it did involve my girlfriend, but it wasn't sex. No, I finally saw Black Panther.
Oh.
My girlfriend wanted to see it, and I said, you know what? It's a Marvel movie. It's made a shitload of money. I want to know what's going on in the culture. So I saw Black Panther.
So Daniel, you paid for a ticket to three billboards outside of Ebbing, Missouri, and then went to Black Panther? Or
no, I used my Movie Pass. So I did not pay. I have paid $10 to Movie Pass, to which I can see whatever movies I want. So it did not cost me an extra cent. I actually probably would not have seen Black Panther if I didn't have Movie Pass.
MoviePass is not a sponsor of this podcast. Okay.
No. Not yet. Call us MoviePass. So here's the thing. What I'm about to say will shock you.
It's a good movie?
It is a well-made movie. Hmm. So it is about the best you will get from Marvel in this modern era. The reason it is it has a good theme that's integrated throughout. It's not as integrated as it could be, but it's integrated throughout. It has a well-defined villain with good motivations. You know who the villain is. You know what he stands for. You know why he stands for it. And you understand psychologically why he got there. It really cuts back on the humor. So it doesn't have like a lot of the humor undercutting the scenes. And it has a clear, defined aesthetic. If I had to define the aesthetic, I would say Star Wars meets The Lion King. Which makes it very interesting, right? We don't have anything like that. So the basics of this movie are, remember Captain America's shield is made of vibranium?
Mm-hmm.
So when that meteor fell, the majority of it fell in the fictional country of Wakanda. And you're going to start poking at the philosophy here. So I will get to that at the end. So I don't want you to like poke holes in this right away. This falls to the fictional country of Wakanda, to which the ruling class takes it and they use the vibranium in the meteor to create the Black Panther. So they make their king the Black Panther. He uses the vibranium to make himself super strong, and they create a suit for him and everything. And through the ages, the ruling family passes down the Black Panther mantle from hero to hero, or from son to son. Now, there is a bit of tribal stuff. There were 5 tribes, and every time it's passed on, any member of the other 4 tribes can challenge the appointed heir to become the Black Panther. And if that challenger wins, that challenger becomes the Black Panther. They also created a technologically advanced city with the vibranium, but they hid it in the same way sort of the gulch is hidden in Atlas Shrugged. They hid it behind like a shroud. They made it look like a typical African country, but inside is this technologically advanced city. But it's still a monarchy, and it's tribalistic. Now, what happens is they have war dogs or spies that they send out into the world. And the war dogs, of course, these are all, I want to be clear, I haven't mentioned race, but it has to be mentioned for this part. Everyone in Wakanda is black. It's in Africa. They're all black.
What?
So these war dogs are sent into one of them sent into Oakland, and he sees the systematic oppression. And he says that, oh man, if we had all the technology of Wakanda, we could overthrow the world and have us be in charge and not be oppressed anymore. Us would, of course, be black people. So the king of Wakanda, this is his brother, goes and kills his brother and leaves his brother's son there. His brother's son grows up to be the villain and eventually is able to take over Wakanda and try and use it for this racial supremacist agenda. He wants to take the technology, send it around the world, overthrow all the governments, and then have it the world led by black people. Of course, it's said that he wants to do this because he was trained by the American government, because he was a soldier, to destabilize governments and take over countries. So the whole thing becomes a statement against Americanism. Ultimately, this entire movie, and I want to be clear, it is an entertaining movie. It is well made. Michael B. Jordan is tremendous as the villain Killmonger. The main guy, I can't remember his name off the top of my head, is very good as T'Challa, the king of Wakanda. It's very well made. It's very good. His younger sister, who makes all the technology, is very good. It's an entertaining movie. But ultimately, what happens is he defeats Nick Cannon's character. Not Nick Cannon. Well, I want to call Michael B. Jordan Nick Cannon for some reason. Michael B. Jordan's character. So racist. But he defeats. I loved Michael B. Jordan in this movie. There were times where I was like, you know, I kind of get where he's coming from. But it's what I was just saying. If they're just going to beat you up, you just beat them up harder. Isn't that what I was just saying in the opening? But
yeah, but not for racial supremacy's sake.
Well, right. That's why I didn't like him. I was like, I'm with you. I'm with you, Michael B. Jordan. But then you turn it into a race thing. Which, again, that was a wise move by the writer-director of the movie, right? If you make the villain the one talking about race, and none of the heroes talk about race, that really gives your movie a lot of benevolence on the audience's part. So it was a good rhetorical move. So ultimately, T'Challa kills Michael B. Jordan, Killmonger, and takes back the throne. And then one of the post-credits scenes is him speaking to the UN, right? The UN, so you know where this is going. And this quote sums up the point of the movie and sums up how the theme of the movie is resolved. The theme is, of course, should we be isolationists or should we go out and help the world? You know, not go out and pursue our own values in the world. He says, T'Challa says to the United Nations, we must look after each other as if we are one single tribe. So again, it gets to the end, and it's not a race thing at the end. It's not a race thing. It's not saying, you know, we're going to protect all the black people in the world as Wakandans. It's saying we have the superior technology. We're going to reach out and trade our technology with the rest of the world and our prosperity with the rest of the world in order to make the world better. But the problem is the whole movie is couched in this idea that this tribalistic monarch, how do you say monarchy as an adjective?
Monarchical.
Yeah, monarchical. I couldn't say that word. This tribalistic monarchical society is the better way of doing it. That is superior to the way it's been done nowadays. And all I could think the whole time is, you guys have all this technology in the middle of the city, and especially there were a couple scenes that were shot on the outskirts of the city, and it looked like a normal African village. It's like, so people have to live in that so you can keep all this technology to yourself and hide it from the world? Because your number one thing is protecting Wakanda. So ultimately, it does fall into the Marvel collectivist trap, and it is promoting collectivism. But it is nowhere near as offensive, and what I mean is offensive, as offensively bad as something like Spider-Man Homecoming. Spider-Man Homecoming is bad because it's disjointed. It doesn't try to do what it's doing as good as it can be. It's an individualistic movie. It's about the individual journey of Peter Parker, but it's couched in this social justice world, and it doesn't work. It's very disintegrated in this way. But this world is pretty much James Cameron's Avatar as best as it possibly could be. So vibranium is unobtainium, essentially. And these people are living in harmony with each other and the world because they're very tribal. So if you gave the best possible interpretation and version of that movie, you'd end up with Black Panther. So it's well done. It's just it has a collectivist message. So I would say, see this movie if you want to see the best thing Marvel is ever going to make in this day and age. This is the exact opposite of, say, an Iron Man or an Iron Man 2. I would say Iron Man 2 might be better than Iron Man, right? We've gone from, I'm going to privatize national security to, we are one collective. We are one tribe, and we have to protect each other that way. So this is Marvel making the movie that it's trying to make the best that it can. I do not think you will see a better Marvel movie in its current iteration as far as what they're going for ideologically and philosophically, thematically. I don't think they could have executed it better. So if you want to see what Marvel is capable of, and you want to see one Marvel movie to see, hey, what's all the Marvel hype about? This is worth seeing. It's entertaining. The performances are good. You're going to enjoy seeing it. But don't see it if you're not able to stomach the collectivist message, because it ultimately is a collectivist movie. It's all about, as I said, we are one tribe and we have to protect each other based upon that. There's nothing about individualism. But it is strange, because at a certain point, and this is where the ultimate contradiction that they can never have an answer for is in the movie. At a certain point, T'Challa has lost the duel. So Killmonger comes back and he says, the challenge isn't over. I'm going to challenge for the throne. I am of royal blood. I have a right to. And T'Challa, as he's bound by the collectivist tribalistic tradition, says, okay, I will battle you. And then he is killed. But when he's killed, he's actually put into a coma, and his body's being kept alive by being frozen in the snow. And when he does that, he has his mystical vision of his dad, who says, you've lost the duel, son. It's time to come home. So he has to, in order to defeat the Killmonger and, you know, stop the evil version of America from supremacy around the world, this racial supremacist plot, and take back the throne, the Wakandan throne, he has to make an individualistic choice. And he has to say, no, I'm not ready to die yet. I still have a battle to fight because I believe this is right. So even couched within this collectivism, there is a romantic individualistic moment. And that is the contradiction that naturalism will never be able to address, that collectivists will never be able to address. You demand, and we saw this with Batman versus Superman and Man of Steel, where people wanted Superman to chain his individuality to the collective. You demand people to be individualism, individuals and make individual choices and chain yourself to the collective. So let me rephrase. Maybe you can't stand the collective message in this, the collective's message, but it's interesting to watch from an intellectual standpoint if you want to understand the ultimate contradiction that will always exist in naturalism and in collectivist messaging. So that's another reason to watch it. But don't watch it if you don't want to deal with any of this. You're just going to get annoyed.
Okay.
Any questions, any comments, any concerns?
Stay tuned for Black Panther 2, Wakanda Checks Its Privilege.
Again, but that's part of the contradiction, right?
Sure.
Like, this is what I don't understand. How can you be about Wakanda forever and making everything great and you're hoarding all the technology to yourself?
Yeah. And not even just yourself, i.e. the whole country, yourself, i.e. the monarch. There are a lot of, looks like, destitute people in Wakanda, at least from what I can
tell. Well, that's the one thing that I wish, like, if I was going to critique something about the world building, is it wasn't clear how many people actually lived in, it was like a literal almost, it was a vibranium tower, it wasn't an ivory tower. How many people lived inside that? Because there was a train system and everything, like public transit. So I really wish they had established how many Wakandans live in there and how many Wakandans live in the village outside of it. It's never established. And they can't establish that, right? It would blow up their entire premise if they made that explicit.
That's what I mean. Black Panther 2 is they go back and fight the oppression in their homeland. Can't wait. Can't wait to not see that one either.
I don't think they'll do that. All right, well, maybe we should talk about some other things you can't wait for and also will not be seeing, huh?
Yes, please.
Trailer takedown. First trailer.
Mary Poppins Returns is Disney's latest nostalgia trip. It's starring Emily Blunt as the titular character. And in this trailer, or teaser trailer, I guess, there's a lot of wind, and then she comes down, and she looks at herself in the mirror, and she says something very Mary Poppins-like, and she walks away, and the mirror looks at her. Her reflection in the mirror looks at her as if she's still there, and was admiring her, and then the trailer ends. For me, and I want to see what you think, Daniel, I have an inkling of what you think. I am looking forward to, the live-action Aladdin, but I think I'm kind of over the nostalgia trip. Like, when I was watching this trailer, I was literally thinking of Julie Andrews. And I was like, is this fair to Julie Andrews? Can this replicate Julie Andrews? Or more to the point, back then we had, it was obvious who the big stars were. So when Julie Andrews played Mary Poppins, it was a big deal. And now we have Emily Blunt playing Mary Poppins. Now, I don't have anything against Emily Blunt. She's talented. I've enjoyed her roles. But is she a big enough star to make Mary Poppins work the way Julie Andrews made it work? Part of the reason that was so successful is she was a huge star. Will that work here? I don't know. I don't know if this is going to be anything other than a poor facsimile of what came before. And that's our nostalgia trip right now. So I think just because of not knowing, I have to tackle this.
Tackle?
Do you have the same feeling, Daniel?
Okay, so first of all, this is not a reboot. This is a sequel. Is that what you got from this?
Yes. Returns implies sequel. Just like when it was Superman Returns with Brandon Routh, it was supposed to be a sequel to the last Superman before that.
I'm kind of confused by that, in a sense. Is Mary Poppins a god? Does she not age? Is she a deity? Is she a fiction of people's imaginations? You know?
Are we eventually going to get Mary Poppins versus Wonder Woman?
That's right. I just can't deal with all of this. I praise the Jungle Book, and I'm into this live action remake of cartoons, as long as it is a remake and not a sequel or something. This is a live action remake of a live action movie. I'm wildly confused, disappointed, bitter, and tackle. I don't know. Disney, what are you doing?
Tackle.
Second trailer.
The Humanity Bureau is Nick Cage's return. Now, I don't know if this is direct-to-DVD. I don't know if this is going to go in theaters. I don't know if Nick Cage actually went anywhere. I think he's been making a bunch of direct-to-DVD movies. But this one is interesting. This one is interesting because he works for a government department called the Humanity Bureau. And in this world that is ravaged by climate change, certain people who don't want to leave their areas they're living in are taken by the Humanity Bureau and sent to, I think, someplace in the middle of America. I'm not sure. It seemed they were taking people from middle America and putting them somewhere else in middle America. What's interesting about this trailer is... Oh, they're taking New Eden. Right, they're taking them from middle America and putting them in New Eden, which I think is somewhere else in middle America. I don't know. What's interesting is, like, one of the people he takes was like, I'm not leaving. I know the truth. And I had dinner in the White House, and there's a Photoshop picture of him eating with Trump. So he's supposed to be like the stand-in for the alt-right, I'm guessing. But then the trailer does an interesting twist where it seems that Nick Cage learns that that guy is right, and there actually is something going on here about that's creepy or weird about New Eden, so he has to rebel against the government. So I am really torn as far as this movie goes. Nick Cage is usually ridiculous, but he looks more reserved in this movie. And it seems like it could be an anti-government thing, and it could be proper for our culture. I don't know. But just because for the sake of time, and there's better things out there, and this is a very confusing trailer, I'm going to have to tackle? Daniel?
This trailer is a hot mess. It's very difficult to tell what the hell is going on. And quite literally, I mean this in full sincerity, for the first minute, I thought this was a parody. Like, I thought this was an SNL bit or something. Especially when they went with the Trump thing and that guy, that was a whole weird scene. I thought this was a joke. Nick Cage, I don't know what you're doing with your life. Whatever it is, stop. 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 Hit the reset button like Hillary Clinton with Russia and do something else. Tackle.
But the fact that it plays like a parody, and I agree with you, doesn't that give some hope that maybe it's offering some sort of different perspective than what most movies are?
Guilty until proven innocent for movies. This looks god awful.
Third trailer.
Chappaquiddick is the movie we didn't ask for about the behind the scenes of Ted Kennedy driving a car into Chappaquiddick and killing the babysitter. Apparently, Kate Mara loves playing characters killed by politicians. She seems to have been typecast in this role because she plays the babysitter. Oh, this is what I was thinking when I saw this. And this is if you follow me on Facebook, you said I had a Harry Potter joke chambered for this episode. Here it comes. Too bad he wasn't playing Chappaquiddick, because then there would be a snitch and we would know everything that really happened in this.
That's what you waited all week for, folks.
That's a good one.
Chappaquiddick. Oh my god. So what? God.
I don't so look. Bad. I don't care. I wish our fascination with the Kennedys would go away. Like, does anyone really believe that Ted Kennedy didn't leave this woman to die? Do we really need a whole movie about the anguish behind somebody driving his car into the water, killing a woman, and him not really feeling guilty about it and trying to get away with it? That's the kind of movie we want to watch? Shouldn't the entire movie just be like two middle fingers at Ted Kennedy? Shouldn't that be the entire movie? Tackle. Daniel?
For all the reasons that you're tackling this, I'm hugging.
Hug!
Which is that I want to watch 2 hours of two middle fingers at Ted Kennedy. I want to watch 2 hours of telling the truth about how this guy who is lionized, in fact, he's called the Lion of the Senate by the left in our popular culture. I want to watch 2 hours about how he is a murderer and got away with something horrible and was never held
accountable. You think that this movie will say that?
Yes. Yes, I do. From the trailer, I think the movie will say this, and because this movie is getting panned already by leftist critics and whatnot, I think this is a very anti-Ted Kennedy movie.
Okay, I will add a caveat then. If you see this movie and it is that, I will then see it.
Yes. So there's another reason I'm into this, which is completely has nothing to do with what I just said, which is that I'm into this kind of movie. I'm now fully bought into the fictionalization of these quote unquote recent events kind of things. I'm also watching The Looming Towers on Hulu, which is the story of how 9/11 happened from an FBI CIA perspective. I'm in. It's my new thing because there are no good political dramas anymore, which used to be my thing. Those are non-existent now. So I'm now into this.
Final trailer.
Tully is a movie starring Oscar winner Charlize Theron, written by Oscar winner Diablo Cody, and directed by Oscar winner Jason Reitman. So Charlize Theron, I believe, won for Monster. Diablo Cody won for Juno. And Jason Reitman won for Up in the Air, but he also directed The Marvelous Thank You for Smoking. So I included this trailer because when you put three people together who have won Academy Awards, I think it's a movie you at least have to pay attention to and say, hey, what is this? This movie is basically postpartum depression the movie. Charlize Theron's character has multiple kids. After she has a new kid, she doesn't really want to do it anymore, but she doesn't want to hire a nanny. And then it's all the angst and ennui and drama that comes with not really wanting to have a kid and not really wanting to deal with the consequences. Unfortunately for me, as much as the people involved in this are talented, and Juno was a well-written movie, and as I just said, I love Thank You for Smoking. I've never seen Up in the Air. But because of the way the movie looks in the trailer, it just looks naturalistic to me. And there's nothing about it, despite the talent behind it, that makes me want to see it. I appreciate the fact that they're not going the direction of typical naturalism, which is this victim class. But they are going a direction where even having a normal life is some sort of victim life. You know, just having a mother and being a mother of three kids is a victim life. I mean, they even said it in the trailer where it's like, you have to acknowledge that you made your dream come true, which I'm assuming her dream was having a family. But she's still depressed about it. So, I mean, maybe at the end it could turn romantic. I don't know. I mean, Jason Reitman seemed pretty rational in Thank You for Smoking. Diablo Cody seems pretty smart, although young adult sort of was a little weird and sort of a little social justice-y. So it really could go either way. But still, this is one I would have to hear about what happens with it. Tackle.
Daniel?
This would have to go in the direction, for me, of like Silver Linings Playbook, where it starts off as someone with psychological trauma and then they actually get better throughout the thing in order for me to enjoy this movie. The chances of that happening twice, the chances of lightning striking the same Hollywood twice, Justin, it's just too small. It's just too small. It can't happen. So I'm going to have to tackle.
It's going
to be a naturalistic, schlocky piece of movie about how middle America is oppressed by being normal. So.
Right, which as we saw with like Heathers, the point of Heathers is maybe normal is the new rebellion. So we're going to start seeing pushback against this. And it is disappointing. David O. Russell with Silver Linings Playbook, he's the kind of director who he has taken the side of romanticism. Of course, who got attacked during the Me Too movement? David O. Russell. It's unfortunate to see Jason Reitman, who started with and it really became known for Thank You for Smoking, which was a great, it was middle of the road, it wasn't partisan, even though it was by, what, Christopher Buckley, right, the original book?
Yeah.
Right. So even if it was by someone associated with the National Review, the movie was very much, you know, nonpartisan. So to have someone who started with that perspective and such a good movie go down this road is very disappointing to me.
Looks naturalistic. I would have to hear otherwise. Guilty until proven innocent. Too much to watch.
All right. Let's talk about other things that are guilty until proven innocent. You know, Reddit. It's time for Reddit on Reddit.
These things are all on Reddit. Mostly pics of felines, comma, whoring felines. These things are all on Reddit. No, we didn't post it, but we will repost it.
What is your favorite animated TV series and why?
Do I have to go first?
Well, I mean, you know what I'm going to say, right? I'm going to say DuckTales.
Woo!
Obviously, I'm going to say DuckTales. Even the new one's been pretty good. I haven't had a chance to review it because they've been rolling it out very slowly. I don't even know if they've rolled out new episodes as of late. They did like 8 episodes, 9 episodes, and then it disappeared for a while. Disney has a really weird rollout for their shows. But even the new one is good. It's very... No, I think I did review it. I reviewed the first episode, right? And I talked about how he was an adventure capitalist, which I guess is actually from the original comic book. But it's very individualistic. It's very based on the traditional values. I don't mean this in the conservative sense. I mean the traditional values that made America great. Not in the conservative sense, but philosophically, what this country was founded on, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And the original one really stands out in that it was philosophically consistent in that way.
Yeah.
What about you, Daniel?
There are a lot of ways I could answer this. It's almost as broad as just saying, what is your favorite movie or what is your favorite TV show? You'd have to be like, well, do you compare a documentary to fiction, or do you compare a horror movie to a drama or a comedy to a drama, etc.? So, because there are a lot of subgenres of animated TV shows that are good. I've really enjoyed, throughout my life, X-Men, the animated TV series. DuckTales, certainly up there. Bob's Burgers is a tremendously well-written show. I think, though, and you're not going to like this answer, that's too bad for you, that the show that sort of, to me, stands out as being really well integrated, well acted, the animation not as good as some other shows, but just overall the best, would be Avatar, The Last Airbender. Just overall very well constructed over 3 seasons, had a nice story arc, great character development, etc. But there might be individual episodes of other shows that I like better than any given individual episode of Avatar, The Last Airbender. Star Wars, Clone Wars, I think is an underrated animated TV show. I
can't get past the first season of Avatar. You know that. To me, it plays too much like a video game. It's like, let's go to this land and beat this boss and blah, blah, blah.
They learn. There's character development. There's plot.
Yeah. It's also a couple other ones that we have to mention. There is an arc. There is a narrative. I just didn't like the video game element of it. That's just me. I'm not a big fan of those type of games and stuff. So a couple others that bear mentioning, South Park.
Of course. That's what I mean by like any individual episode of South Park might be better than any individual episode of Avatar. But
yeah. That show Big Mouth, the first season was very good.
Mm-hmm.
And then also I'm really surprised I haven't heard you mention this one. Gravity Falls?
True. You know why that one often doesn't hit my radar? It was so short.
Yes.
There just wasn't a lot of it, which is fine. You can do that. You can have these short-run things. But as far as animation goes, compared to other animated shows, man, it did not go that long at all.
It didn't. But as far as any shows, when we're talking about plotting, the show actually has a payoff.
True. In that sense, it's better than Lost.
That sense is better than a lot of what's on television.
Yes.
All right. Next, Reddit. Redditors who have walked out of a movie in the theater, which movie did you walk out of and why? Now, here's the thing. I think we've talked about this before, and Daniel, you've never walked out, or have you walked out?
I have never walked out.
I have never walked out either. I do not understand why people walk out. At what point, like, are you just like, I'm done with this movie, and you walk out? Like, I don't understand it.
Yeah. The only time I've ever even considered it was Black Swan. And I was just so repulsed by the movie in general that the only thing that kept me there was the fact that I was there with other people, and I really didn't know what I would do with myself. So I stayed and watched the whole terrible, no good, awful, crappy, naturalistic hellhole that is Black Swan.
Yeah, I mean, that is one of the most disgusting movies I've ever seen. I agree with you. If there's one to walk out of, it was probably that one. But now it's a little different for me now because I have MoviePass, right? This podcast is not sponsored by MoviePass, but I pay $9.99 a month and then I can see lots of movies. So I think I'm more likely to walk out now because I didn't invest as much money in the situation.
Yes.
But if you paid $15 to $20 to see a movie, how little do you value your money that you just walk out of the movie?
So here's the thing. this goes along with a story about my wife, which is that she is one to ask for refunds. She has walked out of movies and asked for refunds, like 30 minutes in. And most of the time, they will not give you, like, cash refund, but they'll basically say, sorry you didn't have a good time, here's a ticket to go see another movie on us, or something like that. Which is interesting now, because her view of it is like, well, if I'm not enjoying the movie by 30 minutes in, why would I waste another hour of my life here? Which I kind of get. I've certainly been in movies where I thought, man, I don't need to be here right now. I could be doing anything else. So there's something to that.
Yeah, that's a pretty rational approach. I think it's just different for me because even if I don't particularly enjoy the movie all that much, I can still get something intellectually out of it just by watching it and seeing how it's made. I just think that's a different approach that she has than I do. But I definitely respect that and see that as rational. But again, she has MoviePass now, right?
Yes.
So she doesn't need to do that, correct?
Correct. Now she walks out willy-nilly. It doesn't matter.
Yeah. Okay, well, we've at least found a rational perspective. I guess it's just for me, like, when it gets really deep into the movie, like, I just wonder, like, somebody walked out of Black Panther after the villain was defeated and missed all of, like, the falling, resolving action. It's like, are you really participating in the story at that point?
No, not at all. There are some movies I considered walking out of just to say that I walked out of them, like Fahrenheit 9/11. But instead, I bought a ticket for Spider-Man, not Homecoming, the original Spider-Man, and then went in and saw Fahrenheit 9/11, the only time I ever stole something like that in my life. But I don't care. F you, Michael Moore.
Yeah, I have MoviePass, so it doesn't make a difference. All right, last Reddit. In this
Blue
one...
Dallas, MoviePass. Sorry.
Yeah, see, they should do that advertisement, huh?
Mm-hmm.
That's a good one. They should hire you. All right. I may steal that if I apply for a job at MoviePass. All right, this last one's for you, Daniel. Parents, how did you decide on your child's name? Is it a sudden realization, consensus with your partner, or completely random? And I'm asking because you have decided on a very Jewish name for your child.
To be fair, it's not historically universally considered a Jewish name, but... So the name we settled on to not bury the lead is Isaac. Isaac Thomas will be the name of our son. We'll be coming in mid-July to a theater near you, but mostly near
you. And you can all walk out on the birth.
That's right. Get your money back. MoviePass does not cover the birth of my son, just so you know. So how do we decide? So... Fize and I took a fairly rational approach to this, sort of as rational maybe as you can be, which doesn't make it totally rational, because at the end of the day, you're just picking a name. But, so we had some criteria. One is we didn't want it to be a name that was in the top 10 names for children of, like, the past couple generations. Or not even generations, sorry, past couple years. So, like, Jaden... Any name ending in an N, the letter N, was out automatically. We didn't want it to be a name of someone that we knew personally. Like, so it could be the name of, obviously, a historical figure or celebrity or whatever, but it couldn't be, like, we couldn't name him Justin, for instance, or James, or even Elliot was on our list early on, and we were like, Elliot's in our close circle, won't be named Elliot. So that eliminated a lot of names right there, and then it was sort of a matter of looking at some of the remaining names and just trying to find something that sort of phonetically went with the middle name we wanted, which was Thomas, which is my middle name and my grandfather's first name, so that had to do with family. And then eventually we settled on Isaac. So some rational, some irrational, some phonetic, some family. But it didn't take that long, interestingly. It took us maybe a few months to settle on a name. And we settled on a girl's name while we were there, too, just in case. So,
I don't think enough people pay attention to the phonetic and the musical aspect of names.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, agreed. I guess maybe because I was a musician, that was important to me.
Yes.
There's a weird little segment there that, or sorry, subsection of the musicality of the name or the aesthetic of the name that something Dave Damaschek says pretty often, and I never realized I was doing this as well, but there are certain names that I can't imagine calling a baby. Like, baby Fred. This is my baby, Fred. It's weird, right? Or like, yeah. It was a girl, like Gertrude. This is my baby, Gertrude. It's an old person name. Can't give your baby an old person name. So, another one for me, by the way, because of my name and how much I hate it and growing up, is not easily turned into a name that has an E sound. So, like, Daniel gets turned into Danny. You know, I don't know, other name, whatever. It's mostly girls' names, but boys' names too, so it couldn't be easily turned into an E sound because I friggin' hate the E sound. Just kills me, Justin.
Well, I also think generally can't be turned into some sort of a slur.
We did think about that. Doesn't have a built-in easy nickname. We like that portion of it. Mm-hmm. But like, children are vicious. So
yes.
We suspect that they will find some horrifying nickname for Isaac eventually that we could not have possibly, because the marketplace of children being vicious is just too strong. Can't centrally plan that. Too much vicious market.
But you didn't hand them an easy one like calling him Richard, so they all just call him Dick.
Right, exactly. Indeed.
So all right, I think that brings us to the end of our journey here. What do you think?
Yeah, I'm pretty close. Do you already have any thoughts about names for your children, potential children? At any time in the future, I'm not saying that you're trying to conceive. I'm not trying to reveal.
No, it would be nowhere close, but I mean, I have a hard time not picking things like Ender from Ender's Game or like Sawyer from Lost. You know what I mean? I like names like that.
Pop culture.
Yes. You know the way I am.
Ender would be an interesting middle name, but yeah.
Yeah, right. So there's, no. The long story short is no, I have not thought about these things.
Okay.
I have braces on right now. I don't think I am in any place to be worried about naming children.
Continuing your ever youthful look, you added braces.
I know. I turned 35 and was like, how can I look young still? And I put braces on.
That's right.
Excellent. And holy crap, no wonder kids have trauma in this society. We put mini torture devices in their faces for 2 to 4 years.
Indeed, you just slowly crank it. Just slowly crank it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Jigsaw, live or die, make your choice, man. Wow. All right. What did we learn this trip, Daniel?
I learned that being just ridiculously exhausted plus not having a third co-host makes me damn near incoherent. So I apologize for some of the rambling in this episode. Although I think we did pretty well without James.
Well, yeah, because I carried you.
That's right. And during that Black Panther review, I'm not going to lie to you, I almost nodded off.
Wow. What way to speak highly of my review. My review is so good, you almost fell asleep.
It's more that I did not give a crap about Black Panther and I was not going to see it ever. So almost
I thought that was
there.
A pretty good review, though. I thought that was interesting.
I'll have to go back and listen to it. I don't remember.
Wow. Well, I learned that Daniel's a dickhead.
I'm tired, man. I'm exhausted.
Well, you are definitely playing the role of Dr. Drew this week.
Dude, if James hadn't canceled, there was a chance I was going to phone it in. Be like, nah, I'm out this week. Get someone else. Where's William? Where's Midsider William?
Well, to be James canceled like the night before. It was like 12:30. He was lucky I wasn't asleep.
Yeah. Tired, man. What did you learn this week? Oh, you learned that I wasn't even listening.
Yeah, okay. Well, that was part of what I learned. But to compliment your better half, I've learned a benevolent, rational strategy for walking out of a movie. I am okay with you walking out of a movie if you then, on principle, go and ask for a refund. But if you just walk out of a movie just to be an obnoxious twit because you think the movie is terrible, and then you don't ask for a refund, you're just grandstanding.
Yeah, grandstanders. Grand sit down and finish the movie. Oh my god, I gotta go to bed. Okay, so
I liked that one.
Oh, we already did the learn thing. Jesus Christ. Okay, where are we? Patreon.com/themidside. You can give us money for episodes like this, and hopefully buy me coffee, as I need more of it to stay awake. You know what didn't help? I just realized we had the daylight savings thing. We lost an hour. No wonder I feel exhausted.
Yeah.
Jeez.
Yeah. No, it's terrible.
Awful. We didn't cover
government
this, but Florida...
Government, stop regulating our time zones!
We didn't cover this, but Florida is considering a law just having permanent daylight savings.
Yes!
If there are any more reasons to actually like Florida, there you go.
Yeah!
So.
Oh, that's it. I'm moving to Florida.
We're going to Florida! It's my favorite political meme that is already dead and no one understands it, so.
I got it.
Excellent. So if you learned that Inclusion Rider is a social justice cause, why don't you tell us on social media what that social justice cause would do? I suggested earlier that it would be a shootout at the LGBT corral, but I suspect there are better Western puns to go along with our new hero, Inclusion Rider, and his trusty horse, Triggered. We're at the Midside on Facebook, Twitter, Snapchat, Instagram, Vero, and wherever else you can find Zack Snyder. You can also go to themidside.com/podcast.
What, just hang out by his house in Pasadena, if that's even where he lives?
Yeah, pretty much.
Although, funny story. Mm. So my girlfriend works for a GC, a general contractor. Mm-hmm. And she had to go somewhere to submit their proposal for they were trying to build a new art center somewhere. And I was like, really? She's like, yeah, we're in Pasadena. I was like, oh, we're in Pasadena. And she's like, the college for art and design. And I waited for like five to 10 seconds. And I was like, wait, that's where Zack Snyder went.
Dum bum bum.
That made my day for some reason, because I'm lame.
You're not lame, Justin. You're just a nerd. That's fine. You're a Zack Snyder nerd. Everyone loves it. Except Zack Snyder. Multiple restraining orders.
he only loves the fucking weird people on Vero, dude. Like, Zack Snyder, stop responding to and supporting the weird people on Vero. Stop it!
That's right. Only respond to Justin. That's right. I was going to put a wood block between your feet and hit it with a sledgehammer. Until you write a new Justice League movie. Okay. So, what are we doing? Oh, we're going to iTunes, subscribing there, giving us 5 stars, Google Play, 5 stars. Thanks to Liberty.me for syndicating us. TheMidside.com/store, t-shirts, False Dichotomy Bro. And, tell a friend. Tell a friend about how Sleepy Time Daniel is a weird Daniel. Mm-hmm. But that normally the show is pretty good. You can tell them that. But until next time, get your Z's, and we'll see you next week.
This concludes your journey into the Midside. I'm Justin M. Lesdesky, reminding you that if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce.
Have a nap. Just